I'm actually running this off of a Chrome OS laptop, well, netbook, and which I think makes me pretty brave. No, I'm kidding. So it's all coming from the web. You can download Chrome OS now if you want. So, you want to?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you more or less introduce yourself. And
No. I haven't said anything awesome about myself yet.
Welcome for the second keynote for today at Linux Tag Day 3. So next very interesting topic will be Christy Bohner talking about Google and open source. There's lots to talk about, so please give a hand to Christy Bohner.
Thanks. As you mentioned, I'm Chris. I work over at Google as their open source programs manager. What that means is that I'm tasked with the very exciting job of keeping license compliance and the more exciting job of open source outreach. I also look after some public sector items, but I won't bore you with those. And I had a sort of a unsavory past here at Slashdot and the rest. So. I'm not really big on agendas, so you'll see me, you'll have questions, we'll give away some phones to the raffle winners. We had a quiz in our booth, and so after the talk, you are forced to stay. After the talk, I'll give away the phones, but that's the agenda. So let's talk about open source. A lot of people like to talk in vague terms about what open source actually is. So we decided we wanted to quantify it. So we would know things like how much open source we're actually using as a proportion of that which is out there, and the rest. So what you're looking at here is every file we can find on the internet that has source code in it that is also attached to an open source license. So, and this was done about 7 months ago. We're updating it again soon, 8 months ago. So it's about 31 million files across, you know, a great number of licenses. These are sort of the big 10 or whatever. And yeah, this is a very important slide, not because of these numbers here. These numbers haven't changed for about 12 years. Ever since we started counting open source code or hosting open source code or looking where open source code comes from, it's always been about half GPL, a little under a quarter LGPL, and all the rest permissive licenses for the most part. Over time, there's been a small amount of movement from Apache and MIT and BSD into Apache, it seems, and a little bit of movement away from LGPL and a little bit away from GPL, but not much. Not enough to even notice it practically. Not in the way it is. The movement to Apache has been pretty terrific. Within the GPL, however, about half of GPL software is actually under the new GPL v3 license. Which is what we found in a recent scan. So it's pretty exciting that's remained consistent. You know, it's almost as safe as houses that you can bet that that'll be like that next year too. But these numbers keep on going up, and that's pretty exciting. So to give you an idea of what that means, it's about 2+ billion lines of code spread across those licenses. That's a staggering amount of software that's been written. To give you an example. What's a good? So this is the problem with using K-locks. I don't know if Larry is still in the room. Raise your hand, Larry, if you are still in the room. Good. I can make fun of him. No. Where do you go? So K-locks and lines of code is a terrible way of measuring software productivity, but it's kind of one of the few that we have that's measurable, right? Numerically. Anyway, so that's open source right now. And in case you're ever wondering why. You do what you do. We actually asked 10,000 open source developers back in early 2000s why they do what they do. We said just check off the ones that you identify with. And this is a very good slide. And that's not because it's numerical, which I like, but because you know it says listen, we're all curious about computer science, about programming, about IT. We're still programmers and hackers. We identify with the idealism behind open source. And the way I interpret that is that we say, you know what, this is a science. We are standing on sort of the shoulders of many, many other people. And we should be able to add to that richness. And open source is sort of the way we do that in computer science. And that's really pretty awesome. And the best thing is this number here. So when this was taken back in about 10 years ago, And we're updating it, like I said. People never really, everyone assumed that we, the open source and free software community, were in it because we hated Microsoft, because we hated proprietary software, we hated Oracle. But it was really these reasons and not hate, which is pretty cool. You know, and what's and this is kind of funny too because, you know, yes, we're known amongst each other, but outside of our field, it's not really even about reputation building. You know, having higher page rank because of open source development matters to us, and maybe it'll matter in the odd job interview. But past that, it's not a big driver for us. So, I think this is really pretty awesome. You're all scientists, so you should be proud of that. And there's implications that come from this. Open source developers know that they are releasing things under these licenses, they in general know what these licenses mean. Yes, sometimes people will open source code without realizing the implications of a license, but for the most part, you know what you're doing. You're adults, okay? You know you're giving away software under these licenses. And many of you expect no money for it because you're already being paid in other ways. And if you did, you're all smart enough to realize that you could sell it if you really wanted to, or sell something else. And that's pretty awesome. So what about Google? I should point out that a lot of this talk is going to be about the new video codec. So you'll hit the boring part if you hate video codecs in about 10 slides. You can leave, unless you want to wait around for a raffle prize. So this is Google. Not now, mind you, but some time ago. When we started as a company, our founders basically walked around their dorm, not dorm room, but sort of their academic offices. They found computers that were not plugged in, and they stole them, well, borrowed them, plugged them in, and started using them as sort of data processing mules for their new algorithm, which at the time was called Backrub, which turned into PageRank. This was our last heterogeneous network. You know, we had a bit of mostly Linux, you know, Linux. I think it's an IBM machine and a Sun machine is in here, right there. Some Legos, you know. Mostly running Linux, though. But there was some other things in there, too. Basically, whatever we could beg, borrow, or steal, we would use back then. But that was a long time ago. But it really informed how we designed machines. So Google has never really bought fault-tolerant hardware. You know, server-class motherboards or even RAID, for the most part. The reason for that is, especially when we were starting, those things cost a lot and actually brought little added reliability. Back when Larry and I were still working at VA Linux, we sort of took a look at the dual power supply vendors, where basically you'd have multiple power supplies on the same rails to provide power. And what we found almost universally is they were less reliable than just single high-quality power supplies. And that sort of thing was not unusual. You would pay $100,000 for a fault-tolerant PC server, or you could buy a rack of largely reliable desktop-class machines. So while you were all out there buying your desktop PCs and your desktop hard drives, we were too. We're like, hey, you know, why do we want to hang out with these server guys where the volumes simply aren't there enough to bring down the price of things when we could be buying the cheapest things possible, get a lot more storage, a lot more power, and a lot more memory? And that's true even today. I mean, although we do certainly buy a lot more than we used to and have substantial buying power, you know, we still try to buy things that aren't quite state-of-the-art, that aren't quite the fastest. And sometimes you would even consider them somewhat broken from that perspective. But we say, you know what, we can find our reliability in software. We can find our reliability in Linux. And so that's what we do. So whenever you use Google, you're using Linux. I mean, this is nothing surprising to you guys. But for some audiences, it's still kind of like, wow, really? Every query, all the data processing we do, Gmail, you name it, we're using Linux there. And then we build our software using open source tools and compilers, and then we combine our software, along with open source libraries. To the point now where we've brought in literally tens of millions of lines of code from the outside world. And we build our software. And why do we do it? So I can tell you a story. It's about the French. It's funny, I say that it's about the French and people just laugh. It's like there's some inter-country thing going on here. anyway, so France Telecom, the mobile company, they decided, this was back in 2005, that they wanted to push out the push-to-talk feature onto their network. How many of you know it? Raise your hand if you don't know what push-to-talk is. Just, it's okay if you don't. There's three people. So I'm gonna, that means I can make funny noises. It's just so I can inform my audience. That's when you go, da-da-da, and then you go, and it's like a walkie-talkie more than a phone. That's called push-to-talk. Anyway, so to add that to their network was very costly. Cost them just a bit over $1.5 billion, or whatever they spend there at the time. I think it was before the euro, so you know, shekels, francs, whatever. So they spent a lot of money upgrading their carrier infrastructure. Oh, look, there's someone demonstrating cell phones. Thanks. You know, it works with the story. So they built out their network, and they had a phone. They had partnered with a Taiwanese manufacturer to build a phone, and as they got closer and closer to launch, they noticed that every sixth call was failing. And they're like, this sucks. What's going on? Talked with their engineering staff. Engineers tracked it down to a shared object library in the Windows Mobile operating system. And this is not an anti-Windows Mobile talk. They can beat themselves up. no, seriously, it's a what happens when someone else controls your destiny talk, okay? And so they talked to their account representative at their operating system vendor, and they said, hey, we have this problem. Every six calls, it's dying. They're like, huh, let's look into that. So they went and they talked to their engineers, and they found out that this was a known bug, and that it had been fixed in the next version of the operating system. They're like, oh, fantastic, we'll take that patch. They said, well, it's in the next version of the operating system. They're like, well, that's okay, just give it to us. Well, it's not coming out for a little while yet. And they're like, well, you know, we're shipping this phone in 3 months. And they're like, well, the new version of the operating system is coming out in 18 months. 18 months? Well, sacre bleu. why can't we have it now? And it came down to the fact that they were simply not able to make a special cut of the operating system for France Telecom. So those of you who have worked in large software development organizations know there is a cost associated with cutting a special version of an operating system or a program for any one customer, right? This is known. And so you have to always ask yourself, how important financially is this customer to us? Are they worth the extra effort that this represents for years and years? And they decided that since France Telecom was only some 4% of Windows Mobile sales, that they weren't important enough and they could just go spin. So they turned that button on that phone into, I think, a mute button. out of spite or out of pique, I don't know. And they had another phone that I think was based on Symbian coming out after that, that did support the feature reliably. And so this multi-billion dollar outlay, paying that off had to wait many months. So why do I say this? Why do I tell you this story? So Google, turns out there are some very large companies that don't like us so much. And unfortunately, in the computer business, it is not uncommon if you go into a vendor and say, hey, we need this thing, and they have people who hate you as the rest of their customers, or their only other customer, you'll have a hard time getting what you want. In the world of software, it also means saying to people a lot about your network. So for instance, databases are often bought by the thread. They're bought by the CPU. They're bought by the storage unit. You name it. A new vogue right now, in probably response to cloud computing, is selling software based on how many hypervisors you're running under. I remember I was sitting at a software licensing conference with mostly corporate lawyers in the United States, and they were talking about ordering engineers to shut off hyper-threading and shut off extra cores on chips to save money on software licenses. Think of how appalling that is. Taking 10 years of really all the advances in chip technology to save a couple bucks on Oracle or save a couple bucks on some proprietary software package. Think about this is personally offensive to me, and I can't really explain why, but it's just like, really? And Google's really bad at one thing. Google's really bad at telling you how many computers we have, how many CPU threads we can support, how much memory we have. I mean, I'll tell you now, we have 14 computers. that's not true. I lied to you. I'm sorry. But we have many computers. And if we had to pay by the thread or by the CPU, that would be a lot of money. And it would be a lot of information that we don't want to share. And so what it comes down to is open source gives us the ability to control our destiny. We can do what we want, when we want with our software. And that's pretty fantastic. And that's why we use it. Now, I could stop there and just say, you know what, we use open source, woo! And of course, you'd be wondering why we're here speaking to you. But we don't want to stop there. We really use open source like crazy. We use it a lot. And so it's really important that we understand it, that we know where it's coming from, we know where it's going, and we take part so that we can be part of that direction. So we do a lot of things. We host a great number. Do any of you host any programs on code.google.com? Just raise your hand. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. So we're hosting about 300,000 packages right now, programs, projects, if you will, on code.google.com, where we offer things like version control, bug tracking, and the rest. Like most open source projects hosts, this is a registered projects number. The real number of 7-day actives is more like 50,000 projects, meaning people who have committed software in the last, you know, 7 days or whatever. So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Usually the ratio is actually lower. And it's a pretty solid site. We offer Mercurial and Subversion hosting for free. And one of the funny things is when we started it, what a lot of people would do is they would have their regular hosts, and then they would just sync them with a Google host as a backup. We're very happy to see this behavior, by the way. We think it's really important. And the reason we started code.google.com at all was that we felt that as a community, we had a lot of our eggs in one basket over at SourceForge. So if we just act as a Subversion back into them, or a backup, we're happy. So that's good. We release open source code and free software. Here's the thing. A lot of companies like to talk about, you know, ways of working with the open source community. This is the one that I really wanted to identify early at Google and get people doing. So to talk to open source people, you don't use words. You don't even use presentations like this. You release software. You release code. Because that's the currency that matters. So we've released a lot of things. We've released actually about 840, I think is today's number. We released 2 to 5 new smaller projects a week, amounting up to about 100,000 lines of code, usually hovering around 4 to 5,000. So call it 25,000 to 50,000 lines of code every week for the last 6 years. That's great. That's a pretty fantastic start. Some of those projects are useful, some of them aren't. It's very hard to actually game if they'll be useful or not when you're actually releasing them, by the way. But that's okay. And the reason we do this, well, I'll get to strategic reasons in a second. So we release all kinds of things. So how many of you use GCC? So you're using Google Code in the form of parts of GCC. And many of you are probably using our linker. We identified problems with the GCC linker not being fast enough and missing some things that we wanted from a linker. So Ian Lance Taylor and some others rewrote the linker and released Gold into GCC. So it's like, I could keep going on the list. If you're using Samba, you're using some Google written code. If you're using pretty much every DBCS, how many of you use Git? So Junio, Sean Pierce, they work for me. It's like, you know, you can go down the list and I can say very proudly that you're using Google code, I can almost guarantee it. Everyone who's using a cell phone in this room, with an exception of some of the earlier Symbian phones, you're using Google code directly or indirectly. So that's pretty awesome. So we've released about 19, 18 million lines of code through this process and through our larger projects. We've literally patched every project you can think of. This is just a sampling. We have about 200 engineers patching into open source every month. So yeah, you name it, we have code in them. And then we say to ourselves, okay, that's good, but how's the internet doing? Google's going to do fine so long as the internet does fine. As the internet grows, Google's going to grow. We're sort of keeping up on both the advertising front as well as on the search front. But there was an area that was lagging, and this was about 4 years ago we identified this problem. We wanted people to have very exciting experiences via their web browser, right? So we had released Gmail. We had seen some of the problems people had with Gmail. And a lot of them related to the fact that Gmail, in the end, wasn't running on their desktop, right? It couldn't exhibit all of the desktop behaviors that people had gotten used to. So there's a couple ways you improve that. You do a lot of tricks with JavaScript and CSS and HTML. And was that a dog? cat? Child? OK. Well, that's all right. I have kids. Not here. Anyways, but the point was we needed something that was fast. And also, we felt that a lot of the process models for security isolation were kind of iffy. And at the time, when we started working on Chrome, if a tab would lock up, it would lock up your whole browser. That's still true in some browsers, not all of them anymore. But it was really disturbing to us, because why should your email go down just because you visited a site with lots of pop-ups or other unsavory materials on it? So we threw a team together to work on Chrome. We released it under a BSD license, because our hope was that even if people didn't adopt Chrome, that their browser vendors, whether it be people who are based on WebKit, KHTML, whatever, would be able to take the code and incorporate those changes. And while I won't tell you that IE or Safari have taken our changes on MOS or Opera has taken any of our code, although a lot of it's made its way into WebKit, they have certainly adopted some of our ideas around process isolation and around making their JavaScript rendering engines faster. So we consider it an unqualified success already, even though we're only at like 6 or 7% market share. It was also a really great way of getting HTML5 features out there as fast as possible. So Google really believes in HTML5. We employ one of its main specification editors, Ian Hickson. He works for me. He just had a baby, which is kind of funny because we have a baby in the back there. It's like, Ian? We've been trying to push forward with bringing things like camera support and GPS support and all the rest, which will make us basically able to have an HTML5 that is truly competitive with the desktop experience. A lot of people like to put this in terms of Flash versus HTML5, but it's really not about that. It's about bringing desktop-like experiences to the web browser. Because as the web grows, so does Google. But also, a web that has that kind of capability can be a very competitive place. It can be a very free place. Free as in freedom, where anyone can compete, anyone can put their website up, nobody has to ask permission. And this is actually one of the things I find most offensive about the App Store. Basically, with the internet, we had gotten to a point where we didn't have to ask anyone's permission to put up content. And people seem to be flocking back to this idea of app stores as approval mechanisms for creativity, and that pisses me off. But I don't want to go there right now, because I'll just get upset. And then we have a version of Chrome that's sort of like the whole operating system experience. It's basically Linux, a very thin sort of desktop layer, if you will, and then the web browser. And that's what I'm running this on today. And you can download all these things right now. Another problem we identified about 5 years ago was that cell phone operating systems were beginning to look a lot like desktop operating systems. You had one major player, at the time Nokia, with about 90-some percent of the smartphone market. And then you had a couple of very small players, RIM and the rest, some Sony Ericsson stuff. And we're like, wow, this looks just like the desktop, right? So you had one huge player and a couple of small players. And even as Apple has come out, there's still internationally only something like 25 to 30% of the market. And through the release of Android, Symbian has open sourced their code under the EPL and the rest. But what we actually wanted more than anything else was to get Android to the point where it could become a dominating operating system. And not dominated by Google, okay, but dominated by all of us. So we open sourced it, which meant that people could take it, they could install it on anything they wanted and run it the way they wanted to. Right? We released it under incredibly permissive licenses. It has the Linux kernel, which is GPL, as you know, and then an Apache stack above it, and a couple of little BSD parts here and there, and a couple of, like one LGPL thing in WebKit. So people were able to launch iterations of Android that we had no control over. And we knew that going into this, that people would worry about fragmentation and the rest. And what we counted on was that we would continue to push this thing forward technologically and sort of bring everyone in our draft, as it were, in our wake. And that's, in my opinion, largely worked. We ship quite a bit over 100,000 phones a day now running Android, and those are phones with Google's Market on it and largely also with the feature to shut off Google Market if you want to just install your own software from your own website. And that's been pretty exciting. So probably the most open phone for Android is the Nexus One. This still has about 9 programs that are closed source. But there's literally nothing keeping you from downloading Android, implementing it on your platforms, and going to town. So there you go. That's Android. And I'm happy to take questions. You can start interrupting pretty much any time, especially since I have to sneeze a little bit. Excuse me. Yeah, it's the pollen, you know. So this is Google Wave. You can read that while I sneeze. So maybe I should look at the light or something. So Google Wave is another experiment we've been doing. We have a team in Australia, and they said, what if we think about what we actually do when we communicate online? How would we change it? How would we revise it? And they came up with Google Wave, which is a fairly complex product for doing collaborative work and instant messaging and. So we released that a year and a half ago. We've been releasing parts of this as we go. We released the Federation server, the synchronization servers, and that kind of thing. The UI elements behind Gmail and Google Wave are both open sourced, largely under Apache licenses. The stuff from Gmail is released under a project called Clojure, and which has a JS compiler, JavaScript widgets, JS minimizers, and the rest. And for Google Wave, it uses Google Web Toolkit, which has been open source now for 4 years. So a lot of the components are there. Google Wave is not wholly open source yet. And then there's WebM. So another problem we also identified some 6 years ago was that if you looked at codecs, it's a pretty bleak place for free software for open source. Up until recently, it's been very hard to have a very competitive, and I'll define what competitive means in later slides, video experience for the same relative amount of bandwidth. So I got some crap on the internets for saying that Theora was not as bandwidth efficient as H.264. And people were upset at me for saying this. It was true from a technical perspective, but it was perceived as being too mean. Okay. But in the back of my head, I also knew we were about to buy on two. So I was like, but there's good news. Anyway. So what is WebM? WebM is the VP8 video codec. It is Ogg Vorbis, which is a fantastic audio codec, which I don't need to tell you all about, wrapped in a Matroska-like container. The idea being is that we want to get this codec out there, get people using it and using it comfortably in open source. So it's the code is all under a BSD license. The patents attached to it from Google are under a patent grant that looks very Apache and GPLv3-like. But since we wanted the code to get into Android and to Chrome and to Opera and to Firefox, it had to be GPLv2 compatible, so we couldn't use our favorite Apache license. So we had some bumpiness when we released around our patent grant, but that's all fixed now. And so there you go. And the goal is to get HTML5 to designate WebM as the default codec for the video and image tags. Not image, but audio tags. So that's very exciting to us. And now this is the part where I start talking about VP8. So codec nerds, you'll be happy, the rest of you, well, that's okay. It won't be that painful. And it'll be very educational. So VP8's a lot of things that other codecs are not. Specifically, and probably most importantly, it was designed from the very beginning with multiple cores in mind. We knew this was coming. Onto knew this was coming, everyone did. And it's funny, H.264 implementations sometimes take this into account, but most of the ones that are available to free software developers especially do not. And we also support single instruction multiple data on processors, even if they don't have it themselves. And what this means is that some GPUs and the cell processor and others, they have a hard time sharing data amongst CPU cores, even though they can read from the same memory bits. And so we've come up with ways in the encoder and decoders to accelerate on these kinds of chips, even though they're very, very hard to do. And that's more software tricks than anything else, as opposed to something that's core to the design of the codec. We also, when I say we include the Onto guys that were part of the acquisition, because it wasn't we, like I did it, right? But what they did was, when they were designing it, they designed it with H.264 patent avoidance in mind. They designed it with streaming in mind, which is very important in how we pick the golden frames and the rest, and as well as certain motion models. They're very important. So How do you measure these things? You measure signal to noise ratio, you have the golden, unique original frames, and you compare them against the decoded frames to get your signal to noise readings. You measure speed of encoding and speed of decoding, and you also measure the complexity of both, so you can see how they scale across processors. So we compare against X.264 because we actually can't compare against commercial versions of H.264 without agreeing to constrictive licenses around profiling and around performance checking. So it's funny how often that comes up, actually, because, for instance, if you have a cell phone and that cell phone manufacturer is not a member of the SD forum, then, well, let me say it a different way. If you join the SD forum, which gives you the information you need to read cards above 2 gigabytes in the cell phone space, those drivers cannot be open sourced. So this is why we had to reverse engineer them for Android. So there's a lot of things out there. You have to be actually very careful how you develop if you want to open source. So what you're looking at here, so this is the signal to noise ratio. A higher number is better. For a test video of one of our engineers standing in front of a poster. why are you laughing? He's a nice guy. So basically, this is not unlike a lot of YouTube videos, basically people looking into their webcams, right? So this is a very important thing to us because, you know, we are starting to deploy VP8 across more than 1 million+ videos already on YouTube. This is a little different. This is the sort of the guys walking out to the spaceship walk. With bright colors and lots of whites. So you can see, again, we're remaining very competitive with X.264. And along the top, you'll see the frames and the resolutions. This is a bit faster snap motion sort of video. Again, a very important kind of video for us. But again, this is a kind of video that has a very sort of standard background, basically a lot of grass. So it's a little easier on the codec. This is a very static hall, right? Not a lot is moving here except for this person. So, and that we really shine. But that's not very exciting for people. This is, again, a YouTube-like video and a sport video. Now, what's interesting about this is most sporting events we do okay with, but if you go to this one here, you're starting to see some of the areas where we have to improve. This is basically an extremely highly detailed foliage along with a fast-moving, almost monochromatic waterfall. So we're starting to have a couple of problems here compared with H.264. And again, we have a very uniform color with lots of movement in the form of wavelets. And then this moving across in a very specific way. So this starts to hurt us. So, you know, we know where we have to improve, but for the most part, we can say we're extremely competitive with H.264. Almost everywhere we need to be. And we know where we're going to go next. And the differences between them are not significant enough for us to worry too much from a bandwidth perspective. Because what we care about is data rate on things like YouTube, and it's what you care about when you're surfing the internet yourself. And then you want to keep this as high and this as low as possible. And it's very hard to do. And this is murder for us, right? Because you have a moving windmill, you've got a lot of very small multicolored foliage, and then a very monochromatic with fine details around it. So we know where we have to go with this. What's really great about this is for a fairly powerful multi-core processor, we do quite well. You can see here, basically, we improve performance as we use more cores. This is a little unfair to the X.264 people because they haven't spent as much time making their software multi-core friendly. So it's more to show you that we've taken into account multiple cores. And this is something that really matters to serving organizations, people who serve video a lot, because you'll bring in software, you'll decode it, re-encode it a lot. This is not an atom. And on the rest. So even on single processors, we do quite well. This is on a Snapdragon, which is what's in the Nexus One and the Cortex class of ARM processors. So we're doing pretty well, which is nice because it's nice to be able to encode and decode these things on cell phones, right? And what we found is that even for HD video, we can still leave a fair amount of CPU free to do other things on a Snapdragon. So, this is not a Core 2 Duo. It is harder to do on VP8 right now in software. The larger scale without starting to thrash a bit. So, but that's okay. So over time, what's going to happen with VP8? People are going to start integrating it into GPUs. They're going to start integrating it into the silicon. In the meantime, one of the nice things about VP8 is you can take some of the subtasks when you're encoding the imagery and pass them to a GPU for some of them, not all of them, and get some improvement there. And we're working on that for our software support libraries. And our goal is to have it be the default HTML5 tag, have it be in all browsers. It should be in all browsers by the end of the year, by hook or by crook. Firefox has already said they're going to ship it on Firefox 4. Of course, they're going to ship it on Chrome. Opera said they're going to ship it in their next version. So by the end of the year, for desktop users, you'll have this. Even if I can't imagine there are a lot of Internet Explorer users here, but there are probably some Safari people here. We're going to support those through plugins if they don't integrate themselves. So, and actually, Microsoft has said they won't get in their way, which is interesting and good. So good on them if they come through with that. And honestly, they can't stop a plugin if the plugin's been approved by the user anyway. So it's OK. So that's our goal. And then we'll have really free video online for the first time ever. Sorry, that's not fair to Theora. Theora has been great. But this is going to be extremely awesome. So we're all very excited about this. And it's free. Free as in freedom, free as in beer, free as in cake, whatever that means. You know, like I already said, open source with proper patent grants. We opened the specification as well, explicitly did that. We're trying to maintain very high quality implementations so you can bring them into your programs directly. Free. So including the test streams and test tools. So not that I don't like Big Buck Bunny. It's very cute. But we need more than Big Buck Bunny to push video forward. So there you go. And then just a brief word about Summer Code. We do it every year. We're in 2010 now. 2010 looks a lot like 2009 from a numbers perspective. A little over 1,000 students, 90 countries plus. So we'll have the same pass rate this year as we have the last 3-4 years. How many of you are not familiar with the Summer of Code? Raise your hand. Yeah, so it's a project we do to introduce students to open source software. We pay them to work in open source. And some of them, any Summer of Code students here, raise your hand. Oh, there's one in the back, yay. Oh no, that guy's scratching his head. Yeah, it's been great. We've created about 4,000 new open source developers, of which probably a third have stuck around and a third of their code has stuck around, which is pretty cool. I'd rather take questions, though, if you have some. How are we doing on time here? Oh, so we have 9 minutes? Yeah, is that how it works? Okay. So at the end of the questions, we'll give away the raffle. Okay. So any questions? Yeah. Can you go to a, is there a mic?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a fellow over here.
VP8.
Okay. The VP8 codec, will it be available on Android?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
So we're hoping that it comes out in Gingerbread, although we should have an update for Froyo via the market sooner than later. Yeah, it's very important to us. And we've already tested it. It works great. It's just, it does use a little bit of CPU, you know? So.
64
bits restricted. Amen. Yeah.
Hi, Chris. My question, first off, like, thank you a lot for what Google's doing for free software. I think it's really awesome. But I have some concerns regarding the recent trends with Chrome OS, for example,
uh-huh.
where like all my programs and all my data are going into Google's cloud.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have this freedom that free software used to give me anymore.
Okay.
Is this true or like what's your comment
on this? So a lot of the things that are running on the cloud, they have not been open sourced, right? So it is true. Absolutely. So if that doesn't work for you, then Chrome OS will probably not work for you either as a way of doing things on Google services. So there's that. So let's just be very clear about that. That said, one of the ways we try to address this problem, we have something called the Data Liberation Front, where we go to products like Google Docs and make it very easy to get your data out. So for instance, in Blogger, if you go to the Data Liberation section in your settings, you can in one fell swoop, in one file, download every post, every comment, and all the rest. Similarly, with Gmail, you can download all of your contacts, IMAP out all of your mail, and you can delete your account. So it's not the same as saying, and here's all the software you need to then run these services. But you know, we're trying to get there. Open sourcing everything at Google is actually quite difficult because of the scale of the software. While we do use tens of thousands of lines of open source, it's dwarfed by that which we've written. And so we just don't have the staff to release everything that we want to release. And there are some things, honestly, I'm not going to lie to you, that we feel if we release them, the only people we'd be empowering would be our competitors, Microsoft, and actually just Microsoft now. There's really no other competitor, because they bought out Yahoo's capabilities. So I don't want to lie to you. That's the story.
Yeah. OK. About the Go language, is it under which license is it running, and why didn't you talk about it?
What was the last part of your question?
Why didn't you talk about it, about Go?
You know, honestly, because there's so much that I just sometimes miss things. So I really like Go. Go is a language that was written by Rob Pike and Ken Thompson, Russ Cox, and some other guys. It's meant to be a systems language, you know, so not just for web and for scripting and that kind of thing, although you can write web servers and websites with it. Yeah. And yeah, I'm actually a big fan of Go, but it is a new release. You know, when I talk about things from company, I do judge which ones are going to matter most, and I didn't know if Go would matter to you guys. So I'm glad it does.
Can you tell us under which license?
Oh, I'm sorry. I believe that's Apache. So, yeah, no, maybe it's BSD, but it's one of those two. So.
Okay.
Yeah, but it has some GPL components too, because we use GCC. We wrote a GCC front end until we can go, you know. So.
Okay.
Thanks.
Some questions about VP8. You probably read the blog entry of the X264 developer.
Excuse me.
And about the patents included and the very similar techniques in VP8. Mm-hmm. How are you going to assure the open source community they're not threat? There's no threat about the patents?
We're not going to assure you. All we can do is say the patents that we have on VP8 are being granted to you. You know, there's no guarantees. It's funny, when you do a issue 6.4 license, you don't get an indemnification either from other vendors who might have other codecs. It's just they're saying, you have access to our patent pool. So we're doing the same. We believe we're fine. That post was a little disingenuous to a lot of us, but you know, people are going to criticize, and that's okay. Like, for instance, he said, you guys are running afoul of all these patents, but you're not using B-frames, which is a big deal. And we're like, you know, we didn't use B-frames, frankly, because to do so would have put us afoul of a lot of these patents.
Yeah.
And we went to the golden frame model, which, you know, if you look at VP8, you'll get into that and why they're different. They're very, very different. So there's no safety in the world. And we're just going to have to see what happens. If you're really worried about MPEG-LA suing you, which is a legitimate worry, you can wait and see what happens. And maybe you'll be vindicated, and maybe you won't be.
What about his suggestion to put it out as RC before actually releasing it?
That's chicken shit, frankly. you know,
there's some other guys. I won't say any names that say that they had some improvements and told you they were under NDA before, and you ignored the suggestions. And they definitely know about video codecs. So.
Okay, maybe we did. I hope not. You know, I hope we paid attention to the people giving us early feedback. But you know, they're kind of separate issues. You know. You know, it's funny, because if you look at Google's open source projects, you know, there's a broad spectrum of what you'd consider an open source project. We have projects that look very closed, and we have projects that looked very open, you know, from the very beginning. So, you know, it's all on a spectrum. And the On2 guys, you have to realize also, it's really, really hard when you're a public company buying another public company, especially in the United States, to talk to each other until both boards and both shareholders approve the merger. So the On Technology merger was announced, you know, a year and a half ago, but it only closed about 6 months ago. right? So all during that time, communications were really, really hard. So they probably did talk to your friends, and in the chaos that follows a merger like that, they might have just gotten lost in the shuffle, which would be too bad. So did you want to ask a follow-on, or no? Oh, hardware implementations. They'll come in time. You know, I mean, hardware takes longer than software. So, microphone.
He said he talked to a few hardware guys and they're really having a headache implementing some of the features.
Yeah, so
into
there's going to be headaches.
Silicon?
Yeah. Yeah, I have sympathy for them, but this is like, you know, programming's hard, you know, sometimes. I don't mean to just sort of shrug it off, but, you know, writing GPUs, writing codec, codec decoders, it's hard. It's hard work, you know. And yes, there are certain things you can do in the specifications of these things to make them better or worse. But in the end, you're just stuck sometimes with the hardness. And I have sympathy for that. Let me announce the raffle winners because I think we're about out of time. So
have we time for?
We do two
questions.
Yeah, let me just name Daniel DeWald from Amarok. If you're here. You can just see us up here, or you can visit our booth. Pavel Ruznak from SUSE. Michael Hruseki from SUSE. SUSE is a big winner of phones today. And Ralph Gottschalksen from ADIN, A-D-I-N. We have a phone for you. And if you're not here, we'll mail it to you. So go ahead and visit our booth in stand 204 in 72A to get your prize. So, or come visit us up here. Question?
Chris, you talked about that VP8 will be implemented in Firefox 4. I'm back here. How will this be done in Linux? Will there be some kind of shared libraries that other applications can use that? Do you know of other multimedia frameworks that will implement it?
Yeah, so VLC implemented it actually during the week that we were sort of fixing the patent license, so they listed it as non-free. It is free now. But yeah, so it's implemented for VLC. You should talk to the MPlayer guys. I don't know if they've done it yet. I have actually no worries at all that they will support it within the next couple of months, because they're very fast. They're very productive developers. That said, there's nothing keeping you. So here's the funny thing about purchasing commercial codecs. It's actually not allowed by the license for you to use, for instance, a codec that ships with QuickTime or with Windows Media Player in things like VLC. I mean, people do it all the time. But it's not licensed for that. VP8 is explicitly licensed so that you can do that. So if it happens to be installed by some other program and you have the ways of accessing that, great, more power to you. You know, if that's kind of what you're asking, I'm not sure if it is. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, the VLC guys and the MPlayer guys are crazy productive, so I'm not worried about that in the slightest. Yeah. But him first.
Referring to the need for something like WebM, my question is, did your team or the respective persons look into something like Dirac?
Oh, Dirac. So Dirac is a really neat codec, but the encode and decode times, well, the encode times are crazy. The decode times aren't bad. The encode times, the last time I looked at it, which, by the way, has been a while, were very, very long, you know? Like so long that we couldn't picture using it, even though we have a lot of computers. So so that's been the problem with Dirac. Great decode times, really great quality, great bandwidth, but the encoding times were so high that we couldn't use it. And I really hope that's where they focus. So, yeah.
Maybe you could support it in Google Chrome.
I did. So 5 years ago, I offered them money. We've given them students in the Summer of Code, but it hasn't really worked out from a decoding standpoint. So, dude in the back, one last one, I guess. Yeah, one last one.
Just a simple, two simple questions.
Yeah.
How much do you pay? How much does Google pay per year for the MPEG 4 H264 license for YouTube decoding? How much?
You said you had a second one too.
Yes. Oh. The second one is there are in multiple countries what is called procedure. You know, a court procedure for declaration of non-infringement.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you have a product in the UK, you can go to court and say, What about it, ask the judge to judge if your product is infringing this and this and this and this and this patent. Mm-hmm. And this procedure is also available in the US. So I was wondering, why does Google doesn't go to court, ask for declaration of non-infringement against all MPEG-LA patents, and then all the users will have certainty that there is no problem with patents. And if you don't do that, why not a just simple user doesn't start a procedure so that we, at least, all the users can have legal certainty?
So the first question, how much do we pay to MPEG-LA is basically your question. We pay to MPEG-LA fees around YouTube encoding and decoding. We pay MPEG-LA through fees associated with Android, H.264 performance, and there's a couple other places like that. So it's well over what you would imagine a cap would be, because the caps actually apply per product area and not per company. So. But I'm not actually at liberty to say how many millions we're talking about. As to why don't we fight harder in Europe is sort of what you're asking. Why don't we bring them to court? There's two philosophies around patents. In the United States, you know, the idea is we're going to have a patent pool that we use defensively against people who might sue us around our technologies. And we've joined things like the Open Invention Network and the rest because you have to. You don't have an option of not having software patents and having money in the United States. In Europe, the patent spectrum, thanks a lot to the work of people in this room, by the way, is a lot more reasonable. There was a danger of it becoming worse, but a lot of people in this conference, in this room, fought very hard against it. So the question is, do we want to prompt the patent apocalypse, as it were, in Europe? I'm not sure. You know, this is a discussion we have. It's like, do you want to hasten that which is kind of inevitable? Around patents, and we haven't been that company. You know, we don't want to have the fight too early in countries inside Europe, right? And even in the United States, because yes, a lot of people feel it's going to happen, that everyone with every patent is going to sue everybody else who has any other patent or technology they think might be infringing. But we don't want to be the ones who kick off a war like that. So, you know.
And a final one. Over here.
So obviously, open source is doing very well over here in Europe, and governments are adopting open source standards like OpenOffice.org and Linux in governments. Sometimes it seems that, especially in the US, open source is not doing as well as it's doing over here. What are you thinking? What the reasons are?
Why is open source doing better in Europe than in the US? So I would agree with you, by the way, both from an adoption standpoint on desktop technologies, web browsers, that open source is doing better in Europe for the common client than in the US. I think it's doing fantastically in both places for servers, but you know, why? I don't know why. You know, I think that Europe has been more open to new technologies. They're more intellectually liberal, and I don't mean politically liberal, but intellectually liberal about trying out new things. And that's been true, actually, since the beginning of computer science. You know, you saw a flourishing of 8-bit and 16-bit platforms, you know, the Amstrads and all the rest that you guys had. While we, as a culture, for some reason, in the United States, tend to have a winner-take-all mentality on things. So I think it's a cultural problem. but it's funny, it works for us in the server space, right? It works against us in the client space. So and then you could say there's a force multiplier because of the way that we ship technology out that affects Europe. But, you know, yeah, sort of tongue in cheek, when someone would ask me, is this the year of the Linux desktop? I would always say, no, it'll be in a couple years. I would always say that. Didn't matter what year it was. It's funny, too, because as we've moved to mobile, I really do believe that Linux is mobile now. I think the iPhone is a blip, and that it's just going to be Android everywhere, which is good for all of us, because if we screw it up, someone else can take it over. So there you go.
So I think, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.